Today's class is going to be concerning eating the forbidden fruit. Now, the story of the forbidden fruit in the world of Christianity, they talk about Adam and Eve ate from the apple. So I want to tell you right from the start, the tree of knowledge of good and bad, which we're going to get into, was not an apple. You can still call this thing here an Adam's apple if you want, but that's not what it was. The actual fruit that it was, maybe we'll get to it, maybe we won't. It's actually not important for our class today. And I would like to start off today's class with a question that is so obvious. I actually asked it last week in a different context. But when you get into the custom that learning means asking questions, you're going to not be afraid to ask questions, even about God, because truth is not afraid of questions. Certainly God is not afraid of your questions. And what am I talking about? So now we have the Almighty with His tremendous plan and accomplishment, the entirety of the universe. Everything that we've learned in the previous classes, seven of them, I believe it is, actually eight, one is not, the recording is not being published, which we know. So eight previous classes, and everything that we will ever learn, and then some, which will take a few lifetimes to learn. And look at what happens. I'll never forget, there was one year in the Olympics. There was the 100-meter, it was not a 100-meter dash. It was the competition of long jumping. In other words, at a certain point, you got to jump, and you land in, I guess, sand, so you can see exactly where you land. Now, that jump, it takes a few seconds. How long do they train for it? Longer than any of us would like to know. And one year, this guy, obviously if he made it to the Olympics, must have been quite the athlete, and he loses himself. And he runs into that sandbox type of thing. He didn't do the jump. So obviously he was out. And you just look at that. And Olympics is not really my thing. I happen to have seen this, but it had such an impression on me what it would be like to have such a grand plan and then to fall so flat on your face to everybody's view. Now imagine the Almighty makes this plan, and the very first pinnacle of His purpose, meaning the first Adam, the first human being, who is going to divide into man and woman as we spoke, and this first man and woman is just going to blow it, to get it all wrong. And what we are going to find out is that so much of what we endure during this life is on account of what happened then. Now, whether that's fair or not, I'll say it this way. It's as fair as children suffering from nuclear fallout from Chernobyl. It isn't fair. Those are the facts. So how we have to understand this, that Almighty God makes a plan and He gives one instruction: don't touch the wet paint. Do whatever you want. The whole monkey bars, the bowling alley, the whole toy store, everything is for you. Just don't touch the wet paint. And of course, this kid, he wasn't a kid. He was formed as an adult. He has to touch the paint, and now he blows it. Because what happens when he touches the paint, and then, oh, it's wonderful. You want to join me? And then they press the fire alarm. And they all come in and they hose the whole place down. The whole place is kaput. So that's my analogy for the story of eating from the forbidden fruit. And today we'd like to make sense of it, but I'd like to say something else. Because I know most of you have not been here for a long time. I've actually mentioned this on occasion, but we're going to do it much more thorough justice today than I have ever done before. So even if you've heard this before, you're going to hear some things that are quite unique. Because not only did this man not jump and he ran into the, whatever, the sandbox, whatever they call it, it was on live television. And what does the Almighty do? Well, if he was me, in quotes, bury the story, sweep up the mess, start again. Instead, what does he do? He says, listen, you know this story? How my first handiwork, who has the freedom to choose between good and evil, how he blew it? I want it written with all the details on the first page. So what is that all about? Now, I just want to go back to a comment which you may have thought was just a side comment that I'd repeat because that's something that I feel I should repeat about questioning, feeling comfortable questioning even God. Here, I didn't just repeat it because we should always be asking questions. And somehow in the West, people have, you'll excuse me, this attitude, which I believe comes from Christianity, that you cannot ask questions, especially not hard questions. And Judaism is totally the opposite. The hard questions are the best ones. So what I'm saying here is, since the question is so obvious, how could you not come to the conclusion that there must be another dimension to the story beyond what I first heard when I was 8 years old, and now I'm 80 years old, and I'm still reading the same story? If there is a God, and he's a little more intelligent than an 8-year-old kid, and I'm supposed to believe in him and have a relationship with him, how could I not dig deeper and say, okay, God, you put this on the front page of the Torah Times, meaning the New York, like the world newspaper, but except that we're reading it every single day. You must be telling me something. Let's find out today what that something is. So with that in mind, let us, on page 16 of the Gutnik Chumash, let's take a look at some of the things that he says. We're going to have to do a little bit of page turning, not too much today. And let's see what it says. It says at the top of page 16, in the 7th verse, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es ha'adam, Ofrim min adam. Okay, God formed man from the soil. We're going to skip ahead. And then it goes on to say, Vayatzmach Hashem Elokim, God planted from the ground, Kol Eitz Nechmed Lamara V'Tev L'Machol, all forms of good trees. Now really, that should belong previously when the trees were first created. But except here, there's something specific, that there's all sorts of trees, and there's also Eitz HaChaim B'Toch HaGan, there's a tree of life, which means that if you ingest from this tree, you live forever. Ve'Eitz HaDa'as Tov V'Ra, and there's a tree which gives us knowledge of good and bad. Now, this verse seems to be saying something that is not necessary. It's saying here that God made all these wonderful trees. You don't have to say that because we said that previously during the 6 days of creation. Really what it should say, that there was in the world two trees and God said, don't eat from them. Now the truth of the matter is it goes into another digression and it starts talking about rivers and why in the world that interrupts the story of eating from the forbidden fruit. That hopefully we'll get to next week if we finish what we need to this week. But for now, let us understand something. When it says here that God created all the wonderful trees for man to partake of, but not these two, what it's telling us is that man has a purpose, and his purpose is to partake of the trees. At this point, this is not our subject today, at this point, man has not yet been given permission to eat animals. That's after the flood, we'll get there. Man is being told that part of your purpose is to eat from all these trees. Why? Because you are going to be elevating the divine energy that's in those trees. Now, that's not the only thing you're going to partake of. But here we're talking about partaking of something that becomes part of yourself, which is specifically food. And we need to remember this point because we're going to come back to it later. That there's a question. If trees are made for us to partake of, because that's part of our purpose to elevate what the trees have, then why does there exist two trees that we're not supposed to partake of? How do they fulfill a purpose? Now, let's pause here for a second and understand that there are many things in this world that we should not partake of. That's not how we fulfill their purpose if we eat them. And I'll give an example, which is a rule instituted for all of humanity by the Almighty himself, which is not to eat a limb of a living animal. Now, that may sound something that one would not do in this part of the world, but I'll just like to enlighten you. Maybe you're aware of this. First of all, if you don't have refrigeration, which they didn't for most of history, and you have an animal and you can, let's say, it'll suffer for a while, and a lot of people didn't care about observing suffering until today. There are people like that. And if you need to eat, and you cannot import tomatoes during the winter, even kings couldn't do that. So you take off a limb, you eat it, tomorrow that cow in agony, you kill it, you eat the rest. But there's another thing. I am told that oysters are eaten alive. In other words, they take a knife and crack open the shell, and there's a living organism inside. They pour some vinegar and they slurp it down. Okay, so that's something that should not be done. Or in the Far East, people who go there visit, and one of the things they came back was to describe how in a restaurant they have snake soup, a live snake, and that's right, and they strip off the skin and squeeze out whatever into the soup. Okay, I know, for us, my point is that one of the ways we fulfill our purpose is by staying away from certain things. Remember how we spoke male and female? You see how now it's coming together? That we are supposed to accomplish certain things, but in order to fulfill our purpose, we need certain things to be a certain way, and we cannot breach them. Eating the limb of a living thing is a way of breaching. So on the surface, one could say that the purpose of these two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge, was to not eat from them, except that there is a problem with that perspective, and it's explicit in the verse itself. Let's go back to the verse. And what does it say? How does it describe the trees? It describes them in a way that was not described when they were created. We don't have to turn back. But if you actually, if you want to, you can go to the bottom of page 10 and the top of page 12. And you're going to see how it talks about the fruit of the vegetation and how it talks about the trees. It does not describe them in an attractive way. As it says over here in verse 9. In verse 9, it says that God made every tree nechmod lemare, that it was pleasant to look at. Actually, the word nechmod, it translates here as pleasant. It's not a bad word, but I'd like to say that the word is a bit stronger than pleasant, because those who know Hebrew know that the word chomda, eile chomda libi. Maybe you've heard of a song in camp. Eile chomda libi. No, okay. Anyway, it says that these are the things that my heart desires. There's a desire. In other words, the trees, their appearance makes them desirable. Now, we understand that if you have two fruit, I'm going to pick on mangoes because I see it very strongly with mangoes. The ones that are like, they have red and yellow, right? Just looking perfect. Now is actually the season, at least in this part of the world, where the mangoes are really, really good. And then you have those that are just green. They didn't get the color. And somehow the color is attractive. So now let's go a little deeper. And we're not even having to go and rely on commentaries. We're just talking about reading what it says. Why does the verse introduce by saying that God made that it should grow from the earth all of the trees that they're desirable to look at? They elicit desire because they have a message. Use me for God's purpose. Oh, all the trees say, use me for God's purpose. So there's a question. How could the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and bad also be desirable to look at, meaning saying, use me for a purpose, and God says, don't use them? Something doesn't quite add up. But all of a sudden, before we even get into it, what we're seeing is just by reading the words correctly in their original Hebrew, what we're seeing is that already the story is not so simple. Why, many people ask themselves, am I being put into this situation? That's a good question to ask. We could say anytime, my purpose here is to do nothing. We could say that. I don't think a conscientious person, and most of us are conscientious people, I don't think a person could walk through life. Well, the reason that I passed by this situation is so that I should do nothing. So therefore, the verse introduces a dilemma. You may say, why does God have to introduce a dilemma? Because in the context of the way he created the world and wanted the world to operate, I'll say this, I have to be careful how I say it. God was compelled, as it were, God isn't compelled to do anything, but God was compelled, as it were, to create a dilemma. And this is a type of dilemma that every one of us visits throughout our life. I just gave an example. Something is calling. Should I do something? Should I do nothing? And I'm going to pick on one other one, which you might say is slightly different. I actually don't think so. And I'm picking on this one specifically because I struggle with this. And I, even though I've established a principle for myself, I'm not happy. I'm not happy with the way I handle what I'm about to tell you. Some of you are going to say, we don't have time to go around the table discussing it, that you handle it different than me. And that's perfectly fine. And it's exactly this point. I am encountering a situation and it's calling to me. And in certain instances, I'm going to tell you exactly which one. It's calling for me and I do something. And in certain instances, I don't do something. And I'm going to be open. I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. I'm driving down the street and I'm at a red light. And there's a fellow there with a card and he's written something. He's homeless and he's asking for money. So do we give money? Do we not? Well, he needs food to eat. Yeah, but don't you know he's going to take the money, he's going to buy drugs? You're just enabling him to go again down the toilet. And even more, maybe this particular time with the money that you give him, maybe he's going to overdose and you'll have a part in him dying. And that's very possible. That's a dilemma. It's calling. Do I do something? Do I do nothing? I'm going to tell you what I have decided for myself, which I'm not comfortable with, because I know that there must be times when I am getting it wrong. There must be. This is what I do. And I'm not telling you to don't follow me on this. You have to search yourself. If the individual is a person where you can see that there's a reason why they can't get a job, they're limping, they're whatever it is, help them out. Give them the benefit of the doubt. But if it's a young person, this is somebody in their 20s, and they're robust, they're more agile than I am, nothing to do with comparison, strong person, they're just out there in the street, then my head tilts towards, I don't want to be an enabler. But I believe there have to be times when I'm wrong. So what I want to say as the next step, and we haven't even gotten into the narrative yet, but look how it's speaking to me. I say to myself and I say to you, and that's why I'm opening myself up to you. If you're in the struggle, should I do something, should I not? You're already in a good place. Because even though you may get it wrong sometimes, but you're not throwing away your conscientiousness about other people in need. So if you have that struggle, okay, thank the Almighty that you're not such a pompous, self-centered, I don't want to finish off the sentence, but you are other person conscious. Thank God that you have that kind of attitude and keep the struggle going. Maybe one day you'll have an insight, maybe one day I'll have an insight and I'll see things differently. I don't know. So that's already the introduction to the story. And now we're going to turn the page. You know, just because I touched on a subject which I could, anytime I bring it up, honestly, I see in everybody's eyes, I see the dilemma. It doesn't matter who I speak to, because we're all normal people. If you're a normal person, you're not just a self-centered, I don't want to say what. So I just want to tell you a story, because this story I heard from a recovered alcoholic. 12 steps, the whole deal, for many years, sober for many years. And he told this story, even though it's not germane to the class, but it's germane to this issue. God makes all of the trees attractive, and maybe there's certain ones I should leave alone. So this fellow was saying that he was living on the street, and he had burned every bridge possible. His mother had thrown him out of the house, and did I say he was living under a bridge? That's what he told me. Yeah, he said actually to the group, living under a bridge, he was starving, hungry. So he crawls up to his mother's home and knocks on the door. He's an adult at this point. No answer. Bangs on the door, no answer. Keeps banging. And finally he yells up to the window, how could a mother not answer the door for her son? And shortly thereafter, the mother slipped, I believe it was $5, if I'm not mistaken, under the door. Now, this is quite a few years ago, whatever $5 could fetch. And he said these words. That was the biggest mistake she could make. Because even though I was starving, I took the $5 and I bought my next fix, not food. I'm just saying, and that story had such an impact. And anytime I have this dilemma, that story is knocking inside my head. So the only consolation that I have for myself is, at least I'm struggling with it. I have not allowed myself to become callous. All right? Yes. Let's be on page 18 and listen to the dilemma that we just introduced and see if you can hear it. All right. So it says, verse 15, God placed man in the Garden of Eden, which is a physical location in the world. If you look in the Ari Kaplan Chumash, you'll see around, if I remember correctly, 12 or 40, something like that, locations in the Middle East that may be the actual place. Obviously, it doesn't carry the sanctity of this moment in time, but that's what it was, the Garden of Eden. He placed him somewhere in the Middle East. And he says, what does he place him there for? La'ovda, to work it. Oh, what did we say earlier about the trees? When it repeats, that God made all the trees because there's a purpose for them to be used for God's purpose. So here, we're being told clearly, he placed them there to serve God, ulashamra, and to protect it from certain things that you don't do. Again, the male and female side of living properly. And now, let's take a look at verse 17. Ume'etz adas tovara, from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, loy soichel mimenu, don't eat from it. And I'm going to point out something to you which I don't expect you to know. There are actually sort of musical notations on the words. And I'm going to read this whole verse, and you're going to hear a pause, even if you don't speak Hebrew. Ume'etz hadas tovara, loy soichel mimenu. Now, if you listen to it, there were a few thought groups there, but the most significant pause was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on the seventh word. See that how it stops in the middle? And then it continues. So in other words, most sentences of the entire Torah are divided into two this way. There's a very small ones that are not. Otherwise, they all are made up, let's call it two clauses. So clause number one, it says, don't eat from the tree of... let me back up for a second. Before that even, the end of verse 16, what does it say? Mikol eitz hagan ochol techel. Eat from all of the trees of the garden. You should surely eat from all of them. And now we have something else. A change of instruction. Don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Pause. Third point. Ki because, b'yom acholcha mimenu, on the day that you will eat from it, most almost you will definitely die. By the way, definitely die. I just want to make something very clear. It doesn't mean you'll drop dead in an instant. If a person, let's say, swallow, has an infection, so maybe it'll take them however many days or weeks, and they die from it. So they started dying with the infection. The truth of the matter is that the moment we're born, the journey towards death has begun. So when it says, on the day you're going to eat it, you're going to die, and then you read the story and he didn't drop dead, this is a misreading of it. It means that's when death is, because death has not yet been introduced to the world at all. So the three clauses, coming back to our point, is first God says, eat from all of the fruit trees. Then he says, don't eat from the fruit tree of knowledge. And then he says, on the day you will eat from it, you're going to die. Meaning you're going to start the progression towards death. You're going to start, let's call it, the spiritual infection from which you're going to die. Do we see some incoherence, some contradictory notions within these three points, or do we not see them? I need some response, if I may. Yes, do we see? First, God says, eat from all the trees. Then he says, don't eat from this tree. Wait a minute. Can we just back up to the previous page? It says, God made all of the fruit of the trees. They were attractive. I'm going to paraphrase. They're attractive, right? And now, not only are they attractive, God is saying, eat from them all. And then the next thing he says, whoops. Kind of like, oh, he made man, male and female stuck together, and he went, whoops, and he divided them into two. We already addressed that last week, how that, obviously, there's a whole story to it, meaning. Now God says, eat from everything, don't eat from this tree. And then he says, on the day, and I don't know if you heard this, because I'm going to say it a third time, on the day you will eat from it, you will die. Is there a prediction on the day you will eat from it? Ooh. Now I'm going to say something. You may not like the way I say it. You may very much like the way I say it. But sitting on the male side of the spectrum, I can tell you that in the world of males, because this was actually in the opening joke last week, which is actually famous, it's all over the internet, it says that about women speaking their own language. So I've come up with a line to describe it for men to sort of understand what this means. That women speak between the lines. I didn't say that's good or bad. Because if you think about art, the artistic expression is the expression between the lines. How many lines are there in the comic strip Peanuts? And I'm picking on a comic strip because the reason it's so famous is not because everybody's belly rolling in laughter when they read it. It's because there were many profound psychological truths and they were perfectly expressed in the deft few brushstrokes of those cartoon characters to the degree that Rabbi Abraham Twersky, somebody who is in his mid to higher 80s, psychiatrist, has written books on psychology interpreting those cartoons. That's right. Three paperback books, which he made, and he befriended the, I forgot his name already, the author of Peanuts, Schultz, that's right. Mm-hmm. And he said that Schultz didn't even realize how deep his cartoons were. He just had it in him. So I'm not saying that speaking between the lines is good or bad. It's actually part of the beauty of this world. You'll notice that men are still wearing suits after I don't know how many hundreds of years, right? But the beauty, you see what I'm getting at? So in other words, if I come into this room and I say, oh, it's dark here, so the next guy's going to turn on the lights. But if a woman says it's dark here, maybe she's saying, I think that the drapes are dated. It's time to get, okay? Oh, the grass is long out there, actually. You know the grass is long out there? If I'm a man, I say that's true. But if I've been in this mindset about speaking between the lines, what's really being stated is it would be wonderful if you took the initiative on your own without me reminding you to cut the grass. I see everybody's sort of getting it, right? Sounds like I'm not in my 20s anymore. Okay, but why did I bring this up? Just to tell you how I think, my opinion. In other words, it's not good or bad. There's male and there's female. That's how it is. And we men are given the struggle to try to put our head inside the female head and to say, okay, let's understand between the lines. So now let's go to the Torah itself. That's why I'm saying this. God says, eat from everything, change gears. I'm not supposed to say that, but I'm saying it. Change gears. Don't eat from the tree of the forbidden fruit. Change gears. On the day that you will eat it, you will die. There's a message here between the lines. So if I want, and I'm just going to follow the attractiveness of the tree, then I'm going to say, of course, God essentially said in his final decision, you know, he made a statement and he went to his appeals court and then it was knocked down and the Supreme Court said, eat from it, I'm going to go eat from it. God is not a man that he should change his mind. That's a verse in the Torah portion of Balak. And certain believers need to read that verse. It's a sideswipe. But my point is, God's first two statements are just as true as the third. So how are we to understand this? See, one of the things that happens is we are presented at times with a dilemma, and each side of the dilemma has a positive element to it and a negative element, and God wants us to pick and choose the right positive and the right negative, the right masculine side of it, the right feminine. I don't want to keep repeating it, but you see what's happening, right? So God wants us to do that. Now, when God created man, he wanted to create that man should have divine ability. In English, you say in God's image. What's the divine ability? To have absolute, utter freedom to choose. Between what? Between good and bad? Okay. So now let's suppose you have a child. Well, not suppose. A child is born. And the child has no notion of good and bad. If the child is being not raised in a jungle, but being raised by human beings, then the child is going to be shown that certain things are good certain things are bad. In other words, in certain cultures, a child may be shown, we're going to do some pickpocketing. That's how we survive. And even though you haven't read the book called Robin Hood, but the case that Robin Hood makes, which is why I wouldn't, after reading all the Robin Hoods as a kid, I would never want my kids to read Robin Hood. But they're fat, rich, etc. That's how they're described in the Robin Hood story. They got money. They got enough to spare. We're just going to take it from them. Now, there's an added dimension which I don't want to get into. We're going to steal from the rich to feed the poor. That goes into other things like communism, meaning to say, right? I know that the government is going to steal from the rich and give to the poor. I'm not going there right now, but what I'm trying to say is that when we have a multifaceted situation, when we are born neutral, but then we're molded a certain way, and I deliberately picked on a way because there are many people, they're not raised to pickpocket or to do what Robin Hood does, but they're raised in a different way. Maybe to blow themselves up on behalf of whatever. That's how they're raised in the kindergartens, and maybe you saw it in the news that even in the somewhere in the United States or Canada, I don't even remember which one it was, they actually had a video of them teaching them this here in the West. But then, we're not like that. We're going to teach them morals. But we all have news for ourselves. None of us is perfect. Our morals are going to be flawed. Doesn't matter who we are. When God makes the first human, because one of the things that if you take a look at verse 18, take a look at verse 18. I know I'm sort of interrupting in the middle. Verse 18 is where God says to the Adam, it's not good for man to be alone. He hasn't even been split between male and female. Like the story is sort of jumping from place to place, just like I did deliberately. So in other words, this is to give us pause. The point is, if God wants human beings to choose between good and bad, He cannot train them. He cannot raise them with the way we raise kids. Because then the reason we are making certain choices is because we were raised this way. So what does God need to do? God needs to place some choices, place a struggle where mankind is going to go inward and are going to choose on which direction they're going to actually be raised. So how do you do that? And now we're going to have a new insight why man was created as one and divided into two. Because as long as man is male and female, so it says previously, God says that He put them in the Garden of Eden in verse 15 to work it and to protect it. So no problem. The masculine side of this Adam is going to do all the work correctly. The female side is going to keep the hands off everything that needs to have the hands off. And everything's going to be great. And there's going to be no accomplishment. Because the minute you're made perfect, there's no accomplishment. So what does God do in verse 18? He's now played out contradictory roles. Everything in this world has something for you to elevate. But some of the things that you need to elevate is going to drag you down to a very deep and dark place. It's going to introduce death. And you might choose that for a reason that we're going to get into soon. Or you might choose your path to just stay away from it and remain an innocent child. And I don't mean that disparagingly, I mean remain innocent. And I'll give you an example, which it kind of pains me to give this example. But until about the 1900s, there was a certain practice in Italy that if they had boys who had beautiful, beautiful voices, they would castrate them, which would cause their voices to permanently remain a child's voice. There's the early days of recording, there's a very unclear recording of actually one of the last such people who was alive. So they're adults singing with a child's voice. And then they finally had brains to outlaw it. That's right, to outlaw it, I know. And they outlawed it finally, thank God. Because obviously these were sterile people, and some people with a snip of a knife had basically decided their fate, that that's what they were going to do their whole lives. My point is that when I say we'd remain children, and that's why I don't like this example, because it's just, if you think about it, if you have half a heart, it just hurts to, you know, if you think about it, you get ill thinking about such a thing. But what I'm trying to point out is that Adam and Chava had a choice to make. We could remain innocent like children, which means we'll be adults with the innocence of a child. I'll use another example, which is also not pleasant. But if you have seen a Down syndrome individual, and let's say they're higher functioning, and they become adults, you see, again, it's a sad thing to see, but when we give an example, it concretizes it, but they have innocence. They have a certain innocence their whole life. And you could say to yourself, how lucky they are to be innocent. Why did God have to make us have, you'll excuse me, puberty, and you'll soon see why I pick on it, because that's not the only thing that happens when you mature. Why did God give us that? And now the world is in such a mess because of puberty. God could have made us all be innocent always. So now what ends up happening is God is stating as follows. And again, God is speaking between the lines. And God needs someone who knows how to read between the lines. If man and woman were still as one, not only is it not good for the reasons that we've mentioned previously and other reasons that we didn't even get a chance to get into, but the problem is that within his own head, there'll be a ping pong. The masculine side is going to say, stay with the innocence. And the feminine side is going to say, did you not hear what it says between the lines? And he says, no, I'm clueless, like in the joke last week. What's that? I'm clueless. I don't know what you're talking about. I'll give you an example, which if you're a man, you'll understand. I'm a man, so I can't help it. That's how I'm going to speak. You can have a flower shop and be successful selling flowers for your entire adult life till retirement for 50 years. And maybe you'll understand flowers well if you're a man. But no one is ever going to melt your heart by giving you a bouquet of flowers or giving you a rose. If you're a man, it's not going to happen. I want you to show me one woman on this planet from the day the world was created until this day, that if you give her a rose, her heart doesn't melt. So if you ask a man, like, why did you give her? I don't know. That's how women are. God made it this way. So in other words, if Adam remains male and female together, so the female side is saying, listen, can't you wake up and smell the coffee? Okay, you don't want to smell the roses. You don't want to smell the coffee? God is speaking to you between the lines. He's saying that on the day you're going to eat from it, you're going to die. He's saying you're going to eat from it. You didn't hear it? He said, I don't know what you're talking about. I've been selling roses for 50 years, and I don't understand why roses, particularly the red ones, why that's a bigger heart melter than whatever. I don't even know the other names. I don't get it. So what do you have? You have a stalemate. No choice can be made that way. It's not good for man to be alone. All of a sudden, we have a whole new insight. And now look at verse 18. Listen to these words. The last two words in Hebrew. God says it's not good for man to be alone. We just told why. He says, I'll make for him a helpmate against him. I know it says opposite him because connector means both. It means opposite and it means against. Opposite meaning, well, I don't have to say about the agitation between male and female because we all understand that. And that's how it's supposed to be. Only in fairy tales do they live happily ever after. I have a theory. Maybe the ladies will tell me that I'm wrong. Why is it that certain types of novels are still able to sell when it's the same storyline 1,000 times? Because it takes, it seems, I've never read them. For me, to read such a book would be like to eat a rag for lunch. Okay? I'm just honest. I'm sorry. I'm a guy. All right? But it occurs to me, and you might, if you tell me I'm wrong, I'm gonna accept it. Because what do I know? That there's a certain fantasy of everything being smooth sailing in the end, living happily ever after. So you're too old to read fairy tales. So this is a sophisticated form of a fairy tale. The princess and the prince, and they live happily ever after. But in the real world, that's not what's supposed to happen. I'm sorry? But this is exactly the point. The point is, I'm going to make a helpmate, I'll make for him a helpmate against him. So that's what the way it's supposed to be. Why? This we already learned last week. Because since there's a projection of divine energy from God, the masculine projection, and we, the creations, are the recipients of that energy, and we're supposed to cultivate it. There needs to be tension and struggle for there to be accomplishment. Otherwise, you're a robot. I'll say it differently. All right. How many in this room have any clue how many times they've blinked in the last 60 seconds? Nobody. Your body needs you to blink. It just happens. If you start feeling every time you blink, something's wrong. You got maybe a grain of sand in your eye. Something is wrong. If you feel every time that heart pumps, you better see a doctor. In other words, when things are perfect, I mean, it was unbelievable to me, even though I know this, but one day I had to have my heart checked out for whatever reason. And I got to see all the multiple angles on the screen of how this machine is working, my heart. And I'm saying to myself, how long does it continue going? What, 120 years? I can't even imagine a year. Like, when does it slow down? And the answer is it doesn't. If there was no tension, then we would be just as automatic as our hearts, as our blinking, as everything else that we're doing. So what's the accomplishment? There is no accomplishment. When somebody gets sick and now you fix it, you see what's happening? You may say, why does God make somebody sick? I don't know. He didn't tell me. But I do know one thing, that he made us to play the feminine role, to have hospitals, and to say, we're going to spend $1,800,000 on you, and we're going to keep you alive. See that? Agitation. So now all of a sudden we have a whole different story. So then what happens? Now let us turn the page. We are on page 20. So now male and female have been split, because if you look in verse 22, God takes the side of the Adam, makes it into woman, and brings them together. Now the drama begins. Last week, when I had you fill out a certain sheet of paper on the subject of male and female, so first we spoke about heaven and earth, heaven on the right side, earth on the left side, and I asked you to write on the right side, objective, and on the left side, subjective. Let me describe objective this way, even though I gave this example last week. Somebody shows up 1 minute late from their appointment. They waited 6 months for the appointment. You're a minute late, sorry, you're out. That is objective. Of course, according to the rule of law, or the rule of just pure logic, 1 + 1 = 2, you're a minute late, the door is shut, the next person's in, you gotta wait in line another 6 months. But if you're subjective, it means that you allow the situation and all of its various elements to be internalized by yourself. And you are now going to allow your specific characteristics to play a role in your decision. Subjectivity. And you're going to say, come on in. Pick up the phone, tell the secretary, just hold off, do things, and fine. 6 months, a minute late, and you let them in. Now, of course, there's a danger in subjectivity. Because here, the guy didn't show up a minute late. He showed up 25 minutes late, and he happens to be your nephew or your niece, whichever one you think is nicer. So now, you see, your subjectivity, you're going to make everybody in that waiting room wait an additional 35 minutes. You're already late from an emergency call. They're already waiting 45 minutes. Now you're going to make them wait another half an hour because it's your nephew, because it's your niece. So subjectivity has a danger to it. But the tension is good, because that's where you get accomplishment. So by dividing men and women, and now he brings them together so they can argue it out. When you argue it out, doesn't mean you have to kill each other with your mouth. You can have a discussion back and forth. I'll just say an example. In the Talmud, on almost every single page of the Talmud, there are arguments between a man named Rav and a man named Shmuel. Rav was older, Shmuel was younger. Rav died first. They're always arguing. And when Rav passed away, Shmuel gave a eulogy. He said, I lost the friend who I was afraid of. What do you mean I'm afraid of? Because if I want to prove my point, I know he's going to give me a good argument. If I have to confront a good argument, I got to know what I'm talking about. I got to work on it. So in other words, they argue in every single page, almost every single page. Rav and Shmuel and Abai and Rava, two pairs. The most arguments are these two pairs. And they're friends, because agitation can be good. It makes you sharp. So God splits the man. And now what are they going to do? So now there is a debate raging between, should the path of God's plan be innocence? If it's innocence, it means we can be much holier. Now, what's this business? And or is it going to be one where we're going to get in trouble, we're going to clean the mess? And I'm going to give you a very practical example. And I'm keeping an eye on the clock, so I'm going to try to be careful here. I'm sorry, because it is after 20 past. I don't want to go too far, but I do have to give this some completion, at least, and then we'll continue next week. So now, what happens is, what is this business of a tree of life and a tree of knowledge? There's another dimension that we need to understand. I'd like us to turn back a couple of pages, and it's on page 16 where we started off. And here it talks about how God planted all of the attractive trees, and he specifies Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life. That means if you eat from this tree, you're going to live forever. What is the meaning, if you eat from this tree, you're going to live forever? It means you're going to internalize what this tree is about. Just like we know very well, nutrition from what you eat, you need certain things to intake physically, you got to eat certain things. And if you need other things, you got to eat other things. So there's this tree of life, just like all of the trees. They're very attractive because this way man gets to want to eat them and he gets his nutrition. This tree, you eat from this tree, you internalize the spirit of life that is never going to end. And there's another one, which is the knowledge of good and bad. Now, it says here the word knowledge, good and bad. Now, I'm going to speak a little mystical, actually in English, don't be afraid, because the word da'at really is conviction. That's more accurate. Knowledge is just simply to know a lot of things, which would work in this context. You know there's good and you know there's bad, and you know how to differentiate, or you think you know how to differentiate. But the word da'at, in the inner teachings, the inner wisdom, it means conviction. Conviction implies comprehension with a drive. It's what happens when you go through a subject so thoroughly that you're left with a single conclusion and resolve. So I use the word in English, conviction. So conviction of good and bad. What do you mean conviction of good and bad? Well, if you go to certain Hollywood types, there's a lot of conviction for bad. And you're going to tell the whole world about it because you're convinced that that's the way to go. And if you go to other places, there's a lot of conviction for good. All of the selfless people who volunteer to be helpful, they have a conviction of good. So now there's this tree, conviction of good, conviction of bad. A baby, let's understand something. A baby has no conviction of good and bad. So a baby walks around after its bath, nothing on, and somebody comes to the door. So what? To the baby, what's the difference? What's the difference is, so I don't have my fig leaf. So like, so what? What does it have to do with anything? Okay. In order for man to struggle with subjectivity, let's just analyze the word subjectivity for a minute. Subjectivity, as we said before, means that what is unique and peculiar to myself is going to influence how I think. I'm a young know-it-all of 19, and therefore I'm going to think and behave a certain way. Subjective. The only way to choose between good and bad, and it should be your choice, is if you're subjective. If you're not subjective, you're a machine. What's the big deal if you're a machine? Then you're like the heart that's pumping. I won't say it's not a big deal, but the way the heart works, there's no choice for the heart not to pump. You don't have a choice not to breathe unless you want to play games with your life. So now, subjective means that you yourself are going to influence, which means you have an awareness of self. Now, some of that awareness of self is overt, and some of it is covert. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, I think things should be a certain way, and they're not, and I fly into a rage. Now, when I fly into a rage, I'm absolutely 100% convinced that I am 100% right. Even though to every single onlooker, not only am I looking like a blithering idiot, everybody can see I'm dead wrong. Subjective, in that case, means that myself is affecting me and I don't really realize it because I'm convinced I'm right And the reason I'm going to go apologize to you a couple of days, a couple of weeks later, or a couple of months later, a couple of years later, is because I'm going to wake up and say, what an idiot I was. Okay. But what about being subjective because I am totally aware of my tendency? There is one area in the human condition where I have the most heightened awareness of self: sexuality. You see what happened? When they ate from the tree of fruit of the, from the fruit of knowledge of good and bad, they had subjectivity. And the ultimate subjectivity is where my sense of self is always felt. So, for example, you can brush by somebody by accident, excuse me, or you can brush by somebody with certain overtones or undertones, however you would like to describe it. And there's a different sense of what's happening to you or what you're doing to somebody else. So in other words, it's in its ultimate, the most intense subjectivity is sexual awareness, which is why when they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and bad, they got to realize that there's this drive that is driven by a certain part of the body. You know, beforehand, they didn't have to have clothes. Why did they have to have clothes? What's the difference between my fingers showing here and I could use them for eating, let's say, or for planting, or for whatever I want, and another part of the body that I use to procreate? Like, what's the difference? In other words, the very claim that the people who go, I'll just say it this way because this area will know what I'm talking about. I don't like to say what it is. The very claim of the people who go to Wreck Beach, when there's no subjectivity, then you can go to Wreck Beach. You're a little kid, there's no subjectivity. But when there's subjectivity, then that will be the greatest driver to the human downfall. Even a general, a president, a prime minister, how the mighty have fallen, an expression from the Bible. How they fall because of this. There's too many examples. You don't even need me to say anything about that. So now we see already the story is beginning to come together. So now we have an argument between a husband and wife. What's going to be? Because Adam says, wait a second, we got to be innocent. We got to be innocent. That's it. There's a tree of life, which after Shabbat, they were going to be able to eat it. And we'll talk about that a bit more next week, because I'm going to wind down right now. And she says, if we're going to really accomplish, we're going to have to deal with leaky diapers. You see how everything comes together in the real world, right? You're not just changing a diaper. I mean, even as a man, I got this when it came to changing my kids, that you're interacting with a human being, right? So what is going to give? So now we're going to close here, and we're going to leave you, unfortunately or fortunately maybe, hanging in the air a little bit. And what does it say in chapter 3, which is on page 20? So it goes on to say that in verse 25, it says they were both naked and they didn't have any shame. We understand why. Now God is going to put into the mix a third element, which is going to possibly trip them up, and possibly not trip them up. And that's where it says, "V'hanochash," and the serpent was cunning from all of the animals. In other words, God had injected cunning into this serpent to introduce a third element, to present them with a dilemma. And one of them was going to be tested. Who's going to be tested? Well, the one who's least subjective is not much of a test. Excuse me, I'm not interested. You say to a man, and he's just, I want to be innocent. I'm not interested. I want to remain innocent. But the woman who is really the subjective one, so if this serpent is injected with cunning and he's supposed to be a third element, then he is going to have a wager with the subjective one. Now, I'm going to leave you with this question. Since Chava understood that God was speaking between the lines, on the day you will eat from the forbidden fruit, you will die, was her following what she was prompted to by the serpent, by the injection of decision-making back and forth, should I not? Was that a sin, or was it fulfilling God's plan? because the way the narrative goes, it's a sin. But if we're thinking subjectively and we understand that God has made this whole division between man and woman so that the subjective one could get into it and could read between the lines, so maybe that's the fulfillment of God's plan. So we're going to leave that question hanging in the air. But one thing we did get from this class where we started. Remember that guy? He planned for the Olympics and he just forgot to jump and he walked right into the pile of sand. So God makes the world and everybody's telling the story and boom, the first human being he makes and he blows it. All of a sudden, we didn't go to some mystical, we just read it by paying attention. But you have to do it in the original Hebrew. That can't help it. As soon as you go to another language, you lose it. But you see what's happening? All of a sudden, God's plan is not only sophisticated, it talks to me every day. Next time I'm facing a choice, even a man, I do have a feminine side to myself. I have subjective. Every person has, we read near that from last week, right? So is my subjectivity too influenced by who I am? Can I muster some masculine element within myself of objectivity? In other words, let's pretend if I was someone else. See what happens? All of a sudden, we read this story and say, oh, wait a minute. This is talking to me every single day. And we will continue next week, God willing.